listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. So happy spring. Today is Monday, March 21st, 2011, and on Write the Book today, you're going to hear a live interview with Vermont author Nancy Marie Brown, whose latest book is The Abacus and the Cross, published by Basic Books. Giving it a starred review for books of unusual merit, Kirkus Reviews calls The Abacus and the Cross a thoroughly engrossing account of the Dark Ages and one of its popes, both far less dark than popular histories teach, and a lively, eye-opening portrait of a sophisticated Europe whose intellectual leaders showed genuine interest in learning. The book is largely the story of Gerbert of Aurillac, who would become Pope Sylvester II. He was the first Christian to teach math using the 9 Arabic numerals and zero. He devised a new abacus that's been called the first digital computer. He made sighting tubes and celestial spheres to study the stars. His students used astrolabes to calculate the circumference of the earth, to tell time, and to plot the orbits of the planets. He wrote treatises on acoustics and logic and tutored kings and emperors. He was also a spy, a traitor, a kingmaker, and a visionary who thought science was the highest form of worship of God. And during his lifetime, he was called the scientist pope. After his death, he was branded a wizard. By tracing the life of one remarkable math teacher, The Abacus and the Cross brings light to the Dark Ages. It reminds us that the major conflicts in our world today between Christianity and Islam, between religion and science, are products of our own age, not historical inevitabilities. Nancy Marie Brown's other works include The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman, and Mendel in the Kitchen, A Scientist Looks at Genetically Modified Food, which was named one of the best sci-tech books for general readers for 2004 by Library Journal. Welcome to Write the Book, Nancy.
Thank you, Shayla.
I wanted to just start by asking how you first became interested in Gerbert of Aurillac.
Well, I like to say it was an act of grace since he became Pope. But I was working on my previous book, which is about an adventurous Viking woman. And she was someone who took part in the expeditions to North America about the year 1000. After she came home to Iceland, she decided to take a pilgrimage to Rome. So I'm writing the last chapter of that book, which is called The Far Traveler, and I'm starting to wonder, well, what was Christianity like around the year 1000, and what was Rome like? What would she have seen, and who was the Pope? And I discovered Gerbert of Aurillac, and he was not the Pope that I expected to find on the seat of St. Paul in the year 1000. He was the leading mathematician and astronomer of his time. He was not someone who thought the world was going to end at the year 999. Which is what I had thought people in, you know, the Christian world thought about the coming year 1000. And that wasn't true at all. He was even chosen to be Pope because he was a scientist. This wasn't just a sidelight. This was what made him come to the attention of the emperor and be chosen Pope in 999. So it was quite a shock to me. And I got very interested in tracing his life and how he came to be Pope and what his influence was on the Middle Ages.
Now, after his time, was this myth propagated that people had been afraid of the year 1000?
People in the Middle Ages were always ready for the world to end.
Okay.
If you read charters and annals, you'll constantly be coming up with things like clear signs announce the end of the world, the ruins multiply. And you'll find a lot of those in the 10th century. But you will also find them in the 7th century, in the 8th century, in the 11th century, in the 12th century. There's somebody who's done a study of this, you know, how many hundreds of years did this, you know, spread? And the idea was that as a Christian, you have to always be ready for the last judgment. It should always be in the front of your mind what you're going to say to God at the last judgment.
Okay.
This did not mean that something was going to happen on December 31st, 1999. That's not true at all.
Right. Okay. And is part of that just living a good life so that you're always ready for the end, or?
Living a good life and...
Well, that's probably more about following the rules back then.
Following the rules. Yeah. It sort of depends. It depends on who you were. If you were a churchman, there were certain rules. If you were a king,
right,
there were other rules. But it was you know, a personal responsibility to be ready mm-hmm. for the world to end.
Okay.
The emperor that Gebert was most who influenced the most was Otto III, who was 16 when Gebert became his tutor. And Otto was convinced he was the next Charlemagne, and that when he became emperor of the world, which was his, you know, grand plan, he was then going to go to Jerusalem and present his crown to Christ in person, who was going to come down from heaven to receive it. And that would be the beginning of the kingdom of God. And so he took this very seriously, that he was the last emperor.
Right.
Now, unfortunately, he died in 1002, so we never knew if this was going to happen.
In his early 20s, right? He died in his 20s.
He was only 22.
Yeah.
It was a great shame.
Yeah. Well, Gerbert originally studied in a Benedictine order of monks, mm-hmm. correct? Then they took on a vow of silence, is that right?
Right?
So this is a small point, but I was very interested to read in your book that they were allowed to use hand signals to convey information. That seemed a little bit like cheating.
It was one of those marvelous little sidelights that you come upon when you're researching something like this. I said, well, what was it like living in a monastery? And really, the most important thing back then in the Benedictine monastery was the rule of silence. And there was only something like an hour or 2 hours a day when you were allowed to talk.
Yeah.
And they had this extremely elaborate system of signs for everything from pancakes to sleeping to good and bad. And pass me the butter, please. And can I have some mustard with my fish? And I think the idea was not that you're not allowed to communicate at all, but that it has to be difficult and that it has to be thoughtful and it has to not impose on anyone else.
Okay.
So one researcher that I thought had a really fine interpretation of this said that it was the only form of privacy that anyone would have in the Middle Ages because they lived so close together.
Right.
The monks were always within sight of another monk. You were never alone.
Uh-huh.
But here you could just turn your back on them and think, and you would not be interrupted.
Hmm.
So it was something very special within the monastery. It would have been hard for a young boy.
Yeah.
But it was something that allowed you that space to gather your thoughts and to contemplate.
Okay. All right. Well, Gerbert loved his time of study and meditation mm-hmm. at the order. And I enjoyed your observation that if he had never had ambitions toward politics, he might have brought much more to the world of science and all those areas that he was fascinated by. When did his ambitions start to grow, really?
I think it was actually forced on him. He left the monastery in France when he was about 17, and he went to study in Spain. And the Christian kingdom of Barcelona was right on the border of Arabic Spain, Muslim Spain, where immense scientific interest was happening.
Mm-hmm.
New things were coming in from Baghdad every day. Things were being translated, astronomy, mathematics, geometry, geography, all kinds of new ideas, including the Arabic numerals. And Gerbert was fascinated by this. He just, you know, he wanted to stay there. But he had a very good rhetorical style. He was a very good writer in Latin and a very good speaker in Latin. And so his abbot liked to have him along because he made a good impression of the school. And so he took him to Rome and introduced him to the emperor and the pope, who both said, well, we don't have anyone here who can teach astronomy and mathematics. We'd like you to stay here and teach the emperor's young son. And then when the emperor's young son became the emperor, suddenly, this was Otto II, another abbot, this one from Reims in France, said, well, we hear there's this great young teacher down in Rome. Let's go nab him. And so they brought him up to started keeping copies of his letters to the emperor and to other abbots and things because he kept being accused of wasting money and being extravagant and not performing his duties as administrator. And these letters are just hysterical because he gets into, you know, shouting matches with people over who owns a vineyard. You know? And you're thinking, go study the stars. You're much better at that.
Right, yeah.
And so it's quite a shame that
yeah.
he ended up spending probably half of his working career just dithering over things like who owns a vineyard.
Right.
Instead of teaching people how to use Arabic numerals.
Right.
He was the first person in the West to do.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned the quadrivium.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was also the
trivium. Yeah, so we have seven liberal arts.
Okay.
Trivium means three and quadrivium is four. So the three were like the elementary, high school sort of grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic, which was debating.
Okay.
And you would get those in almost every Benedictine monastery. And Benedictines were the only kind of monks we had before the year 1000. And so they would all teach that, Latin, of course. It was Latin grammar, not English or French. And then if you were good enough, you'd go to more like a college to study the quadrivium. And that's arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music.
Now, these students are all in the church, right?
They are noblemen.
Okay.
So we have the son of the King of France, and then the two young emperors, Otto, were all taught by Gerbert. We have many, many abbots and bishops, and one future pope that all went to school with him. Noble children usually would get rudiments of Latin, and if they were very good, they might go on. But mostly these are churchmen.
Mm-hmm.
And monks would kind of barter for favors. You know, if I go to Gerbert's school for a semester, I'll bring you back a manuscript.
Okay.
and they did this sort of thing, and that's why we have geometry manuscripts that are obviously the students' notes from Gerbert's lectures in Germany and in Italy and places like that. But you also have many letters that Gerbert wrote saying, "Yes, I know you want me to send back monk Nithard, but he's doing so well, and I think he should stay in the school longer, and he's really a great mathematician, and I know he's not, he's supposed to become a priest, yes, I know this." And he has all these, begging letters, please let me keep my students.
right. Why are his letters available? How have these been saved?
It became a commonplace. I think because Cicero kept a copy of his letters, and they, they studied the Latin masters, and Cicero was one of Gerbert's favorite writers. And I think in some ways he wanted to mimic, the master. So his letters are all examples of good rhetoric.
Okay.
And they are, one collection is almost a how to write a letter collection. Another collection is scientific treatises and papers and things like that. And then there's one that has more of the political, the spying letters and the letters that make you certain that he was, guilty of treason, even though he got off.
Right.
And then the modern editors have taken all these different collections and put them together in what they think might be the chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
So it's now difficult for me to know which one came from what box. But he made copies, and then he would send a copy of his collected letters to one of his students to preserve.
Okay.
And at least in the one occasion that we know he did this, because he wrote a letter saying, "I'm sending you a copy of my collected letters," it was when he was excommunicated by the Pope.
Right.
And so he wanted to have something, that would be that would remain behind even if he lost everything else.
Okay. 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 Sorry.
People think that he was excommunicated because he was a scientist, but that's not true.
Right.
He was excommunicated in an argument over whether the Pope has jurisdiction over who chooses an archbishop in France or whether the King of France has jurisdiction. And since he was very close to the King of France and the King had appointed him, he sided with the King of France, and the Pope pulled out his heavy guns and said, "Well, then I'll excommunicate you."
Right.
And that caused a lot of problems. And later, 100 years later, historians and clerics who did not like him used this as an excuse to make him the magician pope who sold his soul to the devil and who was not someone that you wanted to revere. He was even taken out of the Book of Lives of the Popes at one point.
Oh.
I know. Wait a minute. He's a neat guy.
Okay, well, so you say he's a neat guy. I'm curious, having studied his works and read his letters and spent, I'm sure, quite a lot of time learning about him, do you have a sense of what his personality was like?
I can't stop thinking about him as one of my favorite teachers because he gets so excited about new developments in science, and he just wants to share them. And no matter where the student is and what, you know, trivial things they might have to deal with in their new position, he's constantly writing them letters about, you know, these new instruments or these new theories, and answering questions about, you know, well, how do you find the circumference of a sphere, and how do you find the area of a triangle? And he's so happy to do that.
Yeah.
And then when he talks about his administrative work, and he talks about all of the disputes within the church, he sounds so tired and so depressed. And, you know, I just keep thinking of, you know, one of my favorite professors who, you know, got promoted and shouldn't have been, saying, you know, why can't you just let me teach? I like to do research too.
I don't like politics.
Committee meetings are just awful. Can you imagine these committee meetings? It's hard to kind of get into his mind, because we don't know whether he had a family. You know,
right.
We don't know anything about his parents. He never mentions parents or siblings. We don't think he married, though deacons at that time, and he became a deacon after he was a monk, were allowed to have a housekeeper, not a wife, which is a very fine line. He could have had children, but we never hear about them, so he probably didn't.
Right.
He was accused of it by one of his enemies because he spent so much money, but his answer was, I was buying books.
Yeah.
I was buying books for the library. This wasn't, you know, women I'm wasting my money on. So he, you know, he really was a scholar, and he made very, very intense friendships with some of his students, you know, including the young emperor, who he just really, he was almost the Merlin to this emperor, Arthur.
Yeah.
And he had that sense that, this is the mind that I can shape. This is how I can improve the world. This is how I can make, you know, things happen.
Right.
And then the boy dies.
And we will be the empire again.
We will be the empire. In fact, he had a very good chance of reuniting Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity. Because this young boy, Otto III, his mother was a Byzantine princess.
Okay.
And then he was betrothed to a Byzantine princess himself, Zoe. Zoe gets to Italy the month after Otto dies. She goes back home, and about 30 years later, she becomes the Empress of Byzantium, of Constantinople, so on her own. And so their children would have had this possibility of reuniting the two halves of the church, the two halves of the Christian empire. Who knows how big it could have been?
Right.
You know, they could have had France. They could have had England. It could have been all of Europe together. And he saw this possibility.
And Gerbert died soon after Otto.
He died about 9 months later.
Yeah. So you can sort of see that perhaps this was a devastating blow for him.
You do. More people than me have said that he died of grief. Because he just sort of shuts down after that. You know, he stops copying his letters. The emperor liked the pope, or the Roman nobles liked the pope, and who put him on the throne, and whose army was backing him up. Popes at that time did not have a very long lifespan. Several of them before Gerbert's time were murdered. By competing popes, not what you think of as a good Christian behavior. And some of them were murdered by, or dethroned by, either the Roman army or the imperial army.
Right.
Very, very often you did not have agreement on who should be pope. There was no method of electing one. Yeah. It was just who had the power, who had the backing. Very often, they were not even priests. They were not even church educated. They were good administrators. And some of those were the best popes in the 11th century because they actually could make things run.
Okay.
Gerbert, he was a very good man, but he probably was not a great pope.
I wanted to back up a step from before he was Pope and talk about one of his contributions, which was a rather unique abacus.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how his abacus was distinct from that of the Chinese, which maybe we're more familiar with.
Yeah, when you think of an abacus, most people think of the Chinese abacus, which is beads on a wire in a frame, slanted frame. His was not like that. It was not a three-dimensional thing. It was more like a grid of 27 columns spread out on a countertop. And, in fact, they called it a counter. And that's why we do business over the counter now.
Oh, wow.
Because they did their calculating on this grid on a tabletop. And he had made checkers or markers that, you know, they sort of look like checkers. And each one would have an Arabic numeral on it. And he had 1,000 of these made out of horn, cow horn. And you would place the marker in the right column. So if you wanted to make 5, you would place it in the 1s column. If you wanted to make 50, you'd place it in the 10s column. If you wanted to make 500, you'd place it in the 100s column. And then you'd add your other numbers. So depending on which numbers you wanted to add or multiply, you'd pretty much rank them up the same way we do today if we are doing addition or multiplication or subtraction by hand. Now, most people do it by calculator now, but if you do it by hand, you line them up in columns.
Okay.
And this whole concept of columns is the place-value system of arithmetic, and he is the one who introduced that idea, along with the Roman numerals, into the West. And it took people a long time to figure it out. Say, look, you've got this little piece of cow horn, this little chip of cow horn with a 5 on it, and you're telling me that sometimes it's a 5, and sometimes it's a 50, and sometimes it's a 500.
I don't get it.
They didn't get it, you know. And almost all of the medieval textbooks on how to use the abacus is explaining what column you put it in and what column your answer will be if you multiply a 10 by 100 or a 10 by 1,000.
Right.
You know, and so you don't lose track of your zeros.
Yeah.
And they didn't always use a symbol for zero. If the column was blank, that was okay. But in one of Gerbert's students' notebooks, there is a zero, and he explains that it's a good idea to put it in the blank spot so then you don't forget
about the zero.
That really is blank. And so the zero just meant there's nothing here.
Okay.
It wasn't a number. There's just nothing here.
Yeah.
And so this whole concept of what is a zero, that took another couple hundred years to figure out, too.
Right. Now, it's interesting that they had a hard time with this because, unless I've misread something you said, they had been finger counters.
Yeah.
And they had used their different fingers almost sort of like these different columns, had they not? Or the different joints meant something?
The different joints, the different fingers and the different joints. The right hand was used for the lower numbers. The left hand was used for the larger numbers. But it wasn't ranked up in columns. So
okay.
There was a mental leap that had to go.
Okay.
From you know, how you do this. And, you know, your pinky straight would mean one thing, but your pinky bent would mean a different number. And that was easy to remember. But the 5 counter looks
the
identical.
Same. Yeah.
And you just put it
columns
in a different place on the table, and now you're going to tell me it means something different? So yeah, finger counting is really fascinating when you get into it, because they could do millions, but they had to, you know, add it in their head and then, you know, just keep their fingers to hold their place in the calculation.
Right.
And they also use them as sign language. They could say nasty things by, you know, counting, you know, saying, hey, this guy's a 90, and, you know, we won't translate that one. But you know, they had all kinds of ways in which the numbers actually meant letters, and you could give other monks, you know, secret signs.
Right. This is a time of a lot of code and
You don't think of monks having senses of humor, but they really did.
Well. Okay, so around the time that Gerbert was getting his education, Arabic was the language of science.
Yes, it was.
And there was a focus on academics over differences between scholars, and didn't matter, you know, if you were Arab or Christian or Jew. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how this influenced him in his later approach as a politician, and specifically as Pope.
If you look at Muslim Spain, it's a wonderful example for our present world. Because this was a Muslim kingdom. It was ruled at least for the time that Gerbert knew it, by a very far-thinking and tolerant caliph who believed that Christians, Muslims, and Jews were all people of the book. God had
right.
given them all a book. And this is standard Muslim ideology. And that because of this, Christians and Jews had to be tolerated, and they had to be allowed in the kingdom. And there were different ways in which you could accommodate that, and he chose to be the most tolerant, which meant that they paid a head tax.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to get out of paying your income tax, you'd become a Muslim, but otherwise there was no real advantage. You could have your church, you could have all of your religious rights, you did not have to dress in any certain way. All occupations were open to you, including the army. His chief advisors, one was a Christian and one was a Jew, and he sent them on embassies all around the world and chose which one to send depending on who he was sending them to.
Mm-hmm.
Did not have anything to do with their politics.
Right.
And he encouraged books and information and instruments to come in from Baghdad, which was really the center of learning at the time and had been for about 200 years, where the House of Wisdom was embarked on a grand translation and collection of Greek knowledge, Sanskrit knowledge, Persian knowledge, and translating things into Arabic and expanding them. That's where we got algebra, that's where we get trigonometry. These sorts of things were almost immediately moved to Spain because the Muslims in Spain did not want to be left out. They did not want to be thought of as second-class citizens. And so every young Spanish man who could afford it would have his education in Baghdad and would then bring things back. And so you had this combination of great influx of scientific knowledge in Arabic and a very tolerant society of Christians, Jews, and Arabs living and working together.
Right.
And generally speaking Arabic to each other. You even had masses were sung in Arabic.
Oh, wow.
But then right across the border, we're talking, Barcelona is Christian. Cordoba was the head of the Islamic Caliphate. Barcelona, it was a Latin culture. Latin was the educated language. They spoke a Romance language that became something like Catalan at home. But you had all of these people like Gerbert and his friends who were interested in mathematics, interested in science, and they would hear the news through the ambassadors that went back and forth of all these new books coming into Spain. And so they would go to Cordoba and get what they could get. They would invite the ambassadors to bring with them scientists or books or anything that they could get. And you see very few examples of this happening, but there is one famous book in Spain right now that was written in Latin, one of the first books to include Arabic words. And in it, the writer says, "Now the part that follows next was explained to me by the wisest of the Arabs as he was teaching me." And this person who wrote it was Bishop Miro of Girona, who was Gerbert's best friend Spain. And so you see there's like hints of these connections of things that we could have found. But in order to do some of these translations, you needed to have an Arabic speaker, you needed to have a Latin speaker, you sometimes needed a Greek speaker. And so they didn't care what religion you were. If you had the ability.
They needed each other more.
Right.
Yeah.
You were put together in a room.
Yeah.
And you produced work.
Yeah.
Which is really, it's a wonderful concept of a society.
Yeah, and it makes you think about what might have been.
Yeah, and what we could be again.
Yeah, one hopes. I want to talk a little bit about you and what was your background when did you start writing?
I was always interested in writing. I went to Penn State as a writing major. And at that time in the 1970s, there was something called the writing option, where you would take classes in writing, but then you had to take a minor in some field of specialization. And until I was a senior, I couldn't decide whether my specialization was going to be science or if it was going to be medieval literature. And medieval literature won out. And so I specialized in medieval literature. I went on and got a master's degree in comparative literature, studying the medieval field, mostly the Arthurian legends. And then I got into Icelandic saga. And I decided I wanted to go on for a PhD in Icelandic saga, except at some point reality set in. And I realized that there are two professorships, or maybe three, in all of America for PhDs in Icelandic saga. And at that point, I was offered a job working for a magazine at Penn State as a science writer.
Okay.
So I took it. And I worked as a science writer at Penn State for about 25 years.
Oh, wow.
So I went from being the halftime writer all the way up through the ranks to being the director of research publications, in charge of a quarterly magazine, and I think it was 13 websites by the time I left.
And when did you leave? When did that end?
I left in 2003.
Okay.
And we left to move to Vermont.
All right.
And at that point, I was ready to go freelance, and we thought, well, we're going to make a big leap. The economy was really strong in 2003. We thought this is going to be a good idea. And my husband's also a freelance writer, so we knew what we were getting into.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had published a memoir a couple of years before about going to Iceland. And so
that's really called?
My first book, A Good Horse Has No Color.
Oh, okay.
And then I co-authored the book on genetically modified food with a plant geneticist. And that I was in the process of doing that when we moved to Vermont. And after that came out, I decided I really wanted to try to get my love of medieval literature and history and my love of science together
sure.
in a book.
Yeah.
And that's when I discovered the story of the Far Traveler, which is the Viking woman who is involved in the expeditions to North America. And I approached her life through archaeology. So that book is very heavy on modern archaeology and archaeological techniques. History or medieval literature. Are any of them good at math? Not usually. Are any of them good at science? Not usually. That's why you go into the humanities.
That's right.
Because you don't like the sciences. There's not an awful lot of crossover. And even if you get into reading manuscripts, when you get to a page, and I have it actually reproduced in the book, of Gerbert's abacus board.
Right.
It looks like nothing. It looks like, okay, it was a grid, and there's a few numbers, and some of them are Roman, and some of them are Arabic, and what is this?
Right.
What's it all about? You need to have so much background to understand that picture that very, very few people have ever recognized what some of these scientific texts are.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that the professors at Penn State didn't know. People are usually interested in damsels in distress and Merlin the magician and
right.
things like that, not when did Roman numerals be replaced by Arabic numerals.
Right.
It's not something you think of.
I'm wondering if in writing this book you discovered your next subject. Do you know what you're working on next?
I actually don't.
No.
No, I have two or three things that are bubbling. And neither one of them has actually made its statement.
Okay. I wondered if it was going to be, and I'm not going to remember her name, there's a person who appears in this book who had an influence over certain popes. She killed one of them. She married one of them. She
Marozia. Actually, that's a very good idea.
That sounded like a book right there.
That is a good one. Yeah, she was the lover of a pope and the mother of a pope and killed off a few of them in the early 10th century. I actually was thinking of doing the Empress Teofanu.
Oh, she was interesting.
She was interesting, too. She lived a lot shorter life. She was the Byzantine princess who married Otto II and was the mother of Otto III. He was the young emperor who was supposed to be the wonder of the world and that Gerbert was going to make into the next Charlemagne. But the mother, Teofano, is very, very interesting because she ended up ruling the Holy Roman Empire on her own for 10 years. She was addressed as emperor, not empress, because when she was regent for her son, she signed all sorts of things as emperor. And she really put her foot down and said, I'm as good as you guys. And pretty much had to do so militarily, politically, And Gerbert was her spy. So he kind of gave me an insight into her and her machinations. So she's definitely high on the
list. She's interesting.
The woman who ruled the Roman Empire.
Yeah, she's interesting. So I wanted to ask you also, Nancy, what you like to read when you're not writing, and who are some of your favorites, other than Gerbert?
Yeah, it's very interesting because I actually don't read a lot of nonfiction.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
I have to read so much of it when I'm researching a book that when I read for pleasure, I like to read fiction.
Okay. That's
so
okay.
I read a lot of historical fiction, but I find that I have a hard time reading historical fiction set in the Middle Ages.
Oh, yeah. You must be finding everything that's wrong.
I do. And I have these arguments with the writer saying, but don't you know that they couldn't grow oatmeal in Iceland?
Right.
You know, really small things that just kick me out of the book. So I would say that the best book that I have read in the last couple of years is Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel.
Okay.
Which I absolutely loved, you know, about Cromwell. It's not a period I know anything about, and it's a historical novel that just sucks you in.
Okay.
And really makes you feel the period.
Okay.
And then if I'm not reading historical fiction, I do like memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And one that I read recently by Sarah Maitland, who's a British writer, called The Book of Silence.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been a chime in my mind from the idea of the medieval code of silence, because she goes looking for silence in her life and what, you know, silence can bring to her life. And she goes to a monastery in the desert in Syria or someplace like that to experience silence.
Okay.
She goes up into the Orkney Islands and lives in a little crofter's hut all by herself. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'd like to do that. I mean, the Northeast Kingdom is pretty silent. That's where I live in Vermont. We have, you know, days
you have
where
quiet.
You don't hear a tractor.
Right.
So, I mean, I understand, you know, real silence, but I enjoyed that book, too.
Right. Coming from State College, I imagine that was a bit of a shock.
Actually, State College, when I lived there in Pennsylvania, it's very, very rural.
Okay.
And 20 years ago, it was quite a lot like the Northeast Kingdom.
Oh, really?
The problem is it kept growing, and it kept growing. And the university, let's see, I live now near Lyndon State College, which has 52 faculty members. That was the size of the English department at Penn State.
Right. I'm just
Penn State
assuming it's a big
2,500 faculty members and something like 50,000 students. But the town itself was about the size of Burlington.
Okay.
So it wasn't really a big town, and we lived 18 miles out of town on a dirt road.
Oh, all right.
And we didn't have electricity for 3 years.
Wow.
So we lived with propane and kerosene lamps and that kind of thing for the first couple of years of our marriage. And then we decided to leave because they're going to put a connecting interstate highway between Interstate 80 and 90, and it was going to be 4 miles from our house, and we started looking around. And we said, well, what part of the world is like central Pennsylvania 20 years ago? And the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont comes really close.
There you go.
That's great. Dirt roads and not a lot of population.
I just have one more question
uh-huh.
for you. I wanted to know what advice you might have for writers whose work might end up swaying public opinion about preconceived notions, either historic or cultural or ethical or mm-hmm. whatever, because clearly this book changed some of how people look at that period of time.
Well, I think the most important thing is to figure out where did that preconceived notion come from. So what are the footings of it? How did it come to be? And then to do a lot of research to make sure that you really didn't know why you think that's not true anymore. For instance, the question of did people believe that the world was going to end in the year 999? The short answer is yes, but they also believed it was going to end in 799 or 750 or 1030. Yeah, so you look into this question of, you know, did they believe the world was going to end? Yes and no. The other great myth is, did they believe the world was flat? No, they didn't. That idea came into, you know, our common sense knowledge bank in around the year 1400 because Petrarch, you know, wanted to think that the Renaissance was so important, he had to make the Dark Ages very, very dark. And so he started making claims that people in that time thought the world was flat. When if you read the geometry books, it's one of the most common exercises is to calculate the circumference of the Earth. I mean, this is what the students in Gerbert's classes had to know how to do. And if you look around, how many of your friends and peers can calculate the circumference of the Earth?
Right.
None of them.
No.
So these people were very more highly advanced scientifically than I am. They did not believe that if you sailed, you know, toward America, you were going to fall off a waterfall.
Right.
They just didn't know what you were going to find.
Okay.
So you have to look at when, you know, how did that concept come into our worldview so that you can refute it? And you have to do a lot of research in
right.
order to be able to do that. And really, you know, make sure you have your ducks in a row.
Now, how, I said that was my last question, but I'm going to keep going here. How did you approach research in this book? Did you, first of all, did you do all of your research from home or did you travel?
I had to travel a lot.
A lot, I would think.
Yeah,
okay.
I have a list. Let's see, there's over 200 books and articles in the bibliography. I interviewed people in London, Paris, Barcelona, Frankfurt, Munich, Freiburg, Switzerland, and Rome. These were experts in the field of history of science, history of mathematics. One man who studies Gerbert's poetry and really is the only person who has figured out all of the puns and anagrams and acrostics and things that Gerbert hid in these very complicated, you know, seemingly uninteresting poems that have lasted. I mean, you read it through and you say, oh, that's awful. But if you know how to read it, and this man has spent like 15 years just unpuzzling these poems, and so I went and interviewed him because there was no possible way I could understand what he was saying.
Right, there was one poem where all the K's really meant C. And,
yeah, the K's stood for Kaiser. And you had to line them up in a certain way, and then your lines would begin and end with the name Otto.
Okay.
If you read, you know, vertically at the beginning and the end of the line, and so you knew this. Which was a great help because he is the first French monk,
mm-hmm.
and French pope. And so the French have done a lot of work on him.
Okay.
And I do not read German anymore, though I took it in school and I should be able to still read it, but it was beyond me. So I went to Germany and spoke with many of the scholars there who I really wasn't sure exactly what they were saying. So that was one of the reasons I had to go and interview people, was my language skills were not quite up to it. I had a friend help me with some translations from Italian, which is surprisingly like French when you have to read it.
Yeah, on the page,
yeah.
It's interesting. You know, Italian, Spanish,
mm-hmm.
Portuguese. I mean, Spanish and Portuguese.
Yeah.
Because I speak Spanish, I can sort of read Portuguese on the
yes,
page.
You
but
can.
To listen
but
to it, it's so different.
Get it?
Absolutely not.
When we went to Catalonia, I went with a friend who is a Spanish speaker.
Right.
And she couldn't understand anyone because they were speaking Catalan. They weren't speaking Spanish.
Right.
And finally, at the B&B, I tried French on somebody and found out that their French was great. So they spoke French and Catalan, but they didn't speak, you know, classical Spanish.
Right.
And so,
well, probably because they don't want to.
Okay. We didn't know the politics well enough before we went. But,
right.
Yeah, the more languages you know, the better if you're getting into medieval things.
Mm-hmm.
I did find that Google Translates is getting a whole lot better,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even when you have to do Latin.
Wow.
It helps.
That's impressive.
But, you know, you have to be good enough to at least know what paragraph it is that you're trying to translate. You know?
Okay.
So you have to be able to find your place on the page. So that was, it was a challenge. I ended up taking a few French lessons before I went over to France just to brush things up.
Right. Well, listen, this has been a pleasure, and I want to just mention again The Abacus and the Cross, which is published by Basic Books. Where can people find copies of The Abacus and the Cross?
Well, I saw it at Borders down the street. Yeah.
All right, great. So thank you very much for being on Write the Book.
Thanks very much, Sheila.
So more information about the work of Nancy Marie Brown can be found on her page at the National Association of Science Writers website, nasw.org/users/NMB. And as I just said, The Abacus and the Cross is published by Basic Books. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by today's interview with Nancy Marie Brown, whose book, The Abacus and the Cross, challenges common notions about life and understanding at a certain period in time. In your work this week, try to include one thing that challenges a myth or popular conception. It can be historic, cultural, medical, whatever. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. You can also send writing prompts to that same email, and I will happily credit you for any writing prompts that you might share. So Cheryl Willoughby will be up next with the world of music. And this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to Community Radio on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.